Our hot, wet summer made many gardens the perfect environment for pests and diseases this year. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we're going to talk about organic gardening. This summer posed some difficult challenges for organic gardeners. We'll find out how a master organic gardener, Kathleen Dellett of Iowa State University's Horticulture Department, coped. And we'll find out what you can do to leave this summer's trouble behind as you get your organic garden ready for winter and next spring. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here as well, and we will be taking your calls about your yard and your garden. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we're going to talk about organic gardening. All gardeners faced some serious challenges this summer as hot, wet conditions made the garden a wonderful environment for all kinds of bugs and molds and other kinds of diseases. Today, we're going to focus on how organic gardeners coped or could have coped with those challenges. With me now is Kathleen Dellett. She's an associate professor in the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and organic farming and gardening is her specialty. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
What were some of the most difficult challenges that you found popping up in organic gardens this summer?
Well, as Richard and I were talking about on the way over here, 95% of it had to do with the weather. As Richard said, there were, in the months of June, July, and August, we pretty much got all the rain that we normally get in the year, 30 inches here in Ames. So that can wreak havoc on anybody's garden or farm. So as you mentioned, with that, with the excess wet rain, we had a lot of disease and some insect problems too.
I think a lot of people, especially people who are skeptical about the idea of organic gardening, think that beyond weeding and watering, there isn't anything you can do to protect your plants from things like bugs and diseases. But that is not the case. What methods can you use?
Right. You're correct that the biggest principle in organic farming and gardening is prevention. So by having a healthy plant, by having healthy soil, you should be able to resist a lot of insects and diseases. But we also use different strategies, including using resistant or tolerant varieties or cultivars. An example of that is the Mountain Series, Mountain Fresh, Mountain Spring tomatoes developed by North Carolina State that are somewhat tolerant to bacterial blight. Putting your vegetables on raised beds, for example, can help with drainage. Staking them, trellising them to allow a lot of aeration, airflow helps prevent disease. And then straw mulch is also really important in preventing disease.
Why is straw mulch important? What can it do?
It can actually prevent spores from splashing from the soil up onto the plant. And there's a lot of research that's been done on that showing it decreased levels of certain diseases.
So it almost creates a shield.
Exactly. And then we also have row covers, which are those gauzy nets that you can put directly over your plants, or you can put a hoop structure over the plants and then drape the row cover over that, and they're very good for protecting your plants against all kinds of insects, but particularly with cucurbits, they prevent squash bugs and cucumber beetles from eating and also transmitting diseases.
So it would be almost like a person putting on a mosquito net hat.
You got it.
So when these pests invade your garden, if all of your prevention hasn't worked out, what kinds of things can you do to combat them once they're there?
Right. Believe it or not, the easiest thing is hand picking for insects. I had a daily ritual this summer of going out every night after work and picking off all the Japanese beetles and they were on everything this year. That's what shocked me, even on my okra plants, and putting them into some soapy water in a bowl I carried around with me. And it sounds really labor intensive, but I think it was the best solution. Because there are pheromone traps that can attract insects, but I know Donald Lewis said that you might actually end up with more Japanese beetles if you use those. There is a natural product called Doom. I love that name. It's a bacteria, Bacillus populi, and it does kill the larvae of the grub stage of the Japanese beetle. So you can put that on in the fall on your garden, in your lawn. And believe it or not, there's another product called Spikes of Death. Well, it's actually just spikes on the bottom of your shoes you strap on. And I like to sprinkle the doom out there and then walk around with the Spikes of Death and make sure it penetrates down into the lawn. And that seems to really help.
That all sounds so horrible. You think about organic gardening as a very gentle world, but...
No, not when it comes to Japanese beetles.
So this does sound really, really labor-intensive. Why are you committed to organic gardening?
Actually, I never knew any differently. Growing up, my mother came from an organic farm in Minnesota, and we always had a huge organic garden at home. So I didn't know there was such a thing as chemical agriculture until I came to the university. And there I was taught the other side. And fortunately today, in my job, I can compare conventional with organic, and you pretty much can get the same yields in organic. That's the good news there.
But why do it? What do you think the real benefits are?
Oh, well, if you talk to, which I've done a lot of, farmers around the world, they will primarily tell you they're doing it for the environment. They don't want to put pesticides or synthetic fertilizers in the environment. But there's also economic benefits. We've done studies now for 13 years with Craig Chase, an ISU economist, showing you can get 2 to 3 times returns, economic returns, when you use organic practices and sell as organic, certified organic crops. And also there's issues of food safety, where people are more concerned about what they're putting on their food.
We talked about what to do about the Japanese beetles this time of year if you're an organic gardener. But with diseases in the garden, there are problems with those same diseases coming back the following year. What do you need to do in your garden to make sure that you don't run into that problem?
Right. Thanks for bringing that up. Sanitation is also very important this time of year. So the minute your crop is done for the year, for example, we just called it this week and said we're finished harvesting our peppers, bell peppers for the year, even though we probably could have kept them going, of course, till frost. But I just, decided there was enough disease in there that we wanted to clean them out. So pull all the plants out, deep compost them, I call it, bury them deep in the compost if there's any disease on them, and till that soil. And you can do one of two things. You can put a cover crop on it, which we're planning to do. And in that case, it would be something like alfalfa, red clover, or we're planning hairy vetch. And let it rest for the summer and also build up nutrients. And then the other option is some folks do go in and put down composted manure on their gardens in the fall to prepare them for next year. That will help kill a lot of insects out there, too, if you're putting on your compost right now.
You mentioned deep composting to sanitize the stuff that will go back on your garden next year. Why does that work? It seems like putting diseased materials into your compost would just bring the problem back.
No, it'll actually kill it. If you if your compost reaches a temperature of 120 degrees, it will kill the majority of disease organisms. So that's why I say don't just throw it on top, but make sure it's in the pile, in the heated part of the pile. And you do have to regularly turn your compost pile to get the temperature back up.
And when you plant a ground cover in the fall, do you have to be sure that you have enough growing time before frost really hits to get that ground cover going?
Yes, good point. The earlier you plant your cover crop or ground cover, as you call it, in the fall, the better your biomass and nutrient potential from that cover crop will be. However, you are always dictated by when you can get in there. For example, yeah, we can get in right now with after our pepper crop, but we're waiting to put our cover crop down after our field corn and soybean crop. So that won't be until October. Now, we've planned our cover crop as late as November 15th because I do believe the climate is getting warmer. And over the last couple of years, we've been able to plant and get a cover crop up by planting as late as November 15th. Whether we can count on that, it's anybody's guess. But chances are you'll be safe if you plant all the way into November 1st.
You mentioned that you're planting hairy vetch. How did you choose?
Actually, I have to say that I get most of my advice from California. California's led the way in organic research, and there's the majority of organic farmers are in California. And they've been using hairy vetch out there for I would say 25 years now. So pretty much just copied them, and we've been using it now here since 2005, and it works really well. It overwinters here in Iowa.
What are the advantages of using that as opposed to the alfalfa or the red clover that you mentioned?
You might have stumped me on that one. They're all good. They all provide nitrogen. That's the main thing you're going after for your succeeding crop. Hairy vetch may be a little cheaper than alfalfa. I know alfalfa seed's expensive, and don't ask me about economics because I always refer to Craig Chase for that. But in general, I think the hairy vetch is provides a quick growth in the spring, and alfalfa might be a little slower. So you want something that has a quick start, and because you're going to be either plowing it under or no-till farming it in the spring. So you want something to make a quick cover and a lot of biomass early in the spring.
If somebody is thinking about starting an organic garden in their yard next spring, is there anything that they should be doing right now to prepare that ground?
Well, in addition to tilling it up and putting down the cover crop, I think that's the best way. But truth be told, if you wait till spring to till, that's fine too. A lot of folks like to start in the fall because they have time and they worry they can't get in early enough in the spring. However, keeping that cover, keeping some kind of cover over the winter is really important. It's important for soil erosion, you know, to fight against soil erosion, and also to add nutrients to your soil. So I'd say it's a toss-up, unless Richard wants to weigh in on tilling it now or wait until spring.
Well, and we also have Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist, with us today. And we will be taking your calls in just a few minutes. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Richard, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, it kind of depends upon the individual again. If you have, for example, a garden on a slope, I would definitely not till that in the fall. I'd prefer to do that in the spring just because of erosion problems. So it kind of depends upon the area and also how much time you have. If you don't have the time, if you have a flat garden, you can wait and do it early next spring if you really need to. That's no problem. So.
Thanks, Richard.
Well, you can join our conversation. We're going to take a break here. It is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We're focusing right now on organic gardening and talking with Kathleen Dellett. She's an associate professor in the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and she specializes in organic farming and gardening. If you have questions about organic gardening or farming, you can ask her your questions today. And Richard Geron is here, as he usually is, to talk to you about your yard and garden. So whatever questions you have, we can handle them. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we are talking today about horticulture. It's Horticulture Day, as it is every Friday, and we've been focusing for the first part of the program on organic gardening. My guests today are Kathleen Dellett. She's an associate professor in the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and also with us today is Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron. And we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. The phone lines are open, and Sarah has called from Des Moines. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your question?
I'll take my answer off the air, but my question really quick is, when to use bone meal? Is that in the fall or in the spring?
And you want to fertilize?
I beg your pardon?
You want to fertilize what?
I just have a small raised bed.
Yeah. Bone meal basically is phosphate. And I would say most garden soils in Iowa have more than adequate amounts of phosphate, so you probably don't really need to do it. But if you were to do it, you could do it either in the fall or in the spring. Phosphate is not very mobile. It's not going to move if you apply it in the fall. It's going to kind of stay in place. But like I said, most Iowa soils, as far as garden soils, have fairly high levels of phosphate, so the bone meal actually may not be that beneficial.
Oh, yeah. Okay, super. Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I would concur that I look to Richard because we've never used it in any of our organic farming and gardening. And I'm sure that's right, primarily because we have enough phosphorus in the soil. So the importance of doing a soil test before you put down any soil amendments. And also, if you're using primarily the main source for nitrogen for organic farmers is composted manure, and that has phosphorus in it, which should supply any additional phosphorus you might need.
All right. And Sarah mentioned that she has a raised bed. And Kathleen, you mentioned earlier that you use a lot of raised beds in organic gardening. Why are they so important?
Well, I think several reasons. The one I was talking about earlier was drainage. That will increase your drainage. And anytime you have a well-drained soil, you'll have a better chance of resisting diseases, not having wet feet, as it's called colloquially. And also, you can put amendments such as compost right into that raised bed and increase the size of that raised bed. Did you have anything else, Richard?
No.
But you can really control the quality of the soil as well then.
Exactly.
Debbie is on the line in Fairfield. Hello, Debbie. Hi, Debbie. Can you hear us?
Yes. Yes, I can. Thank you.
What's your question today?
We live on a high area, so it was all clay, so I established raised beds and imported sheep and cow manure. And this year, with the rain and the heat and everything got away from me, and I have an incredible crop of weeds. And I'm wondering, can I till this under, or do I need to get out there and just pull all the weeds?
No, get the mower first. My rule of life is if there's a machine that can do it, use it. we actually are mowing a lot of things right now before we go in and do any tillage.
Okay.
And that's the best thing. You know, the additional benefit you might get by backbreaking labor or pulling all those weeds is you will get more root biomass for your, if you're putting in a compost pile. I always compost all my weeds.
Yeah.
But it's not, I mean, those roots will also go back into the soil, so that'll provide nutrients there. We have a joke in our lab that why are they looking at all these non-native biofuel crops when all you need to do is go out in your yard and garden and farm and find all the pigweed out there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's more biomass from pigweed this summer than any of those crops that are promoted for biofuel here in Iowa. That's just an organic lab joke.
Organic lab humor. There should be a book.
So you're suggesting that I put the mower in my raised beds, mow this stuff off, and then till it under?
If you can, okay. You know, get that mower up there. I've also used machetes.
Or a weed eater, those nylon trimmers.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Good luck, Debbie.
Great. Thank you.
I think a lot of people are in Debbie's shoes right now. I've seen a lot of overgrown gardens from this summer. I'm sure you guys have as well.
Weeds just love moisture, and they grow rapidly. And with the moisture, you really couldn't get out there and do things like you normally do as far as cultivating and pulling. It was just too wet, and the weeds don't need much opportunity, so...
Chris is on the line now in Iowa City. Hello, Chris.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
I noticed that last year my roommate and I, it was a small area, live on Dubuque Street in Iowa City. And we have a small lawn. And then in spring when the dandelions first came up, we picked all the dandelion flowers. There were probably in the small area maybe 200 flowers. And then like the next day, there was maybe 150 flowers. And it exponentially dropped off to zero flowers. Now all summer we haven't had any dandelion, but we still have the plant itself. But there's been no flowers for all summer. And I wonder if you guys could do anything about this, or anybody has discovered this before.
As far as dandelions do bloom in the spring, that's when they mainly bloom, and they'll bloom for a few weeks depending on the weather conditions. And then after that, they're just a green plant the rest of the year. So they're most obvious in the spring when they're blooming because you can see those yellow flowers. You can see those white, round puffballs later on.
Yeah.
Very visible. But then after flowering and fruiting, Basically, they're just a kind of a nondescript green plant that stays close to the ground.
What I'm doing isn't really making any difference. It would be just natural progress of that anyway then.
So when you remove them, obviously that prevents them from going to seed, which is a good thing. But the dandelion is very well equipped to spread because those little seeds are like little parachutes. And they get blown by the wind. So even though you pick off yours, the neighbor may not. And then they blow in from considerable distance, or they can. So they're very well equipped to survive in our climate.
Well, and they are wonderful for bees in the spring, right?
Right. And you can make wine out of them, too. Right? You can. So they have some attributes.
As you can tell that I've not gotten the dandelions out of my yard. So I just try to look at their positives and embrace them. So
that's a good philosophy.
All right. The number to call if you have a question is 866-780-9100. You don't have to be a dandelion lover to call the show. Karen is on the line next from Fairfield. Hello, Karen.
Hi. I have some poplar trees in my yard. And when we moved into the house, there were two or three of them that were already dead. And this summer, they've worsened. And I've noticed there are long vertical cracks in the bark on the trunk. And I just wondered if that is indicative of any particular problem and if there's a way to save them or if they should just be taken down.
Not a specific problem, no. Poplars, the one big attribute is that they grow very quickly. That's their big kind of claim to fame, is they grow very quickly. And that's good. But on the other hand, they are prone to a number of insects and diseases. And because they are, the big drawback is they tend to be short-lived. So when they start to decline, most likely that's irreversible, that they probably will slowly decline and die. So that tells me that if I see that, if I have enough space, that I would probably go ahead and plant some other trees, trees that are going to be more long-term in the landscape, like maples and oaks and things like that, where they could be there for maybe 50, 75, 100 years, while the poplars typically are around for maybe 15, 20, 25. So if they're starting to decline, my guess would be that's irreversible. And it's probably due to a combination of things like cankers and insects and things like that. And they'll probably be gone in a few years, unfortunately.
Karen, do you know how old your poplar trees are?
I don't. We just moved into this house a year ago. So they're pretty tall, though. So I would imagine they're, 15, 20 years old now.
Are older, and they're probably, they probably have reached their maturity as far as size and vigor, and my guess is at this point they're probably going to go downhill for a number of years.
All right, Karen, thank you so much for your call. You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. It is Horticulture Day today, and my guests are Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture and also Kathleen Dellett, an associate professor in the Department of Horticulture at ISU. We'd love to hear from you with your questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and I have with me Kathleen Dellett, an associate professor in the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State University who specializes in organic gardening and farming, and Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. They're here to answer your questions, and you can join our conversation by calling 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we do have an email about Japanese beetles. This emailer says that Japanese beetles ate all of the leaves on their white birch tree, so it died. They're after our raspberries. We did the lawn treatment this spring. We used a mixture of dish soap and vinegar and water to spray the bugs on the raspberries and other plants. Now the raspberries are all dying. The leaves wilt, turn dark. Would the vinegar and soap mixture have caused them to die? And do you have any other ideas?
Well, as far as the Japanese beetles and the plants themselves, they typically do not kill plants. They can devour much of the foliage and basically be left with just like skeletons as far as the actual foliage. But that typically will not kill them because the trees, this occurs so late in the year that the trees, the shrubs, have been able to do everything they need to do for next year. It's not a good thing, obviously. It does weaken the plant, but it doesn't typically kill the tree or the raspberry. So if those plants are dying, I would have to think there are other factors involved in this because by themselves, typically, Japanese beetles would not do that.
We talked earlier about some of the ways to try to control your Japanese beetle populations, and let's revisit that a little bit. Kathleen, you mentioned a kind of treatment that you can do in your garden. Is that something that you could also use in a broader area?
Well, I only talked about hand picking and that spray, the mixture of the soap and vinegar. I don't know it. We can't recommend anything unless it's been tested by Iowa State, so I can't say anything about it. If you do put on too much vinegar, it certainly can burn the leaves of the plant. So maybe there was some of that going on if there was phytotoxicity there. But I'm with Richard. I'd be shocked if they were dead. I would leave them and hope that they'll come through next spring. I know for sure raspberries will resprout.
Now, one concern that I would have with the raspberries would be if the actual vines appear to be dying, they could have like a root rot, like Phytophthora root rot or something of that nature. When you have a year like this year, when it's raining all the time and you have very, very wet soils, those very wet soils can lead to a root rot. So that would be a possibility where the raspberries could be dying, but if they are, probably because of a root rot.
So they should dig up their plants, take a sample into the extension office?
I would be inclined at this point to maybe wait and see what they do. And if they really don't come up next spring, then I would assume, yes, they are in fact dead, and I would dig them up and dispose of them. And if the vast majority of the plants are dead, then I would plant new plants, but I would put them in a different location, not the same area, and make sure that the site is well drained because that is very important.
And digging them up right now probably wouldn't make any difference if they're dead.
No,
they're dead.
Right. And at this point, the question is, are they really dead or not? So that should be definite next spring.
You should know. All right. John is on the line from Homestead. Hello, John.
Thanks for taking my call. I've got several mature oak trees in my lawn, and one of them suddenly, the foliage turned brown. I was wondering if that's oak wilt and if I should remove the tree.
Do you know what kind of tree that is?
Yeah, it's a white oak.
It's a white oak. Okay. Boy, that's hard as far as has there been any type of construction activity done around this tree?
Not for 5 years.
Okay, that should be fine. What I think I would do is I would be inclined to go out there, and if you can reach some of the branches, I would prune off two or three branches about a foot and a half in length, about pencil size in width, and immediately put those in a plastic bag and then bring those down to the county extension office and have them send that sample to the plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State. And the office should have a form that you also fill out with your contact information. You also provide some background information on the tree itself. And that's sent to the clinic. They'll examine that and see if they can find something on that. If it is oak wilt, that would be kind of surprising to me if it's a white oak, because oak wilt tends to kill the red oaks very quickly in a matter of a few weeks or a few months. They die very quickly. With the bur oaks and the white oaks, it tends to be much slower. In fact, it may be a year or two before the tree dies. So, but I would send a sample in and have them examine that. And if you can, do this on a Monday or Tuesday. Bring it down to the office, and it should get here by Friday of that week. So it should be a nice, fresh sample.
Okay.
And they'll examine that and see what they can find by doing some tests and things like that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, John. And we have an email from Tom in Johnston, and I know he has a question that a lot of people are thinking about right now, which is about pruning. He says, what are good times of the year to prune low-hanging branches from a red maple tree?
As far as pruning, in reality, you can prune almost any time during the year. It's not going to kill the tree. As far as probably the worst times would be in the spring as the tree is actually leafing out. That's typically not the best time. Or in the fall as they're dropping leaves. So spring and fall are kind of the less favorable times. A good time would be winter, like February or March. Okay, that's a good time. But you can also prune them in midsummer, like in July. That's fine, too.
So right now might not be a good time because we're just approaching that leaf drop.
Well, if you're going to do it now, you need to do it pronto or wait till maybe later on this winter.
All right, so maybe that's in Tom's plans for the weekend. The number to call if you have a question is 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And next up, we have Ken in Ankeny. Hello, Ken.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
We have several large trees in our yard, hackberry, pin oak, emerald queen, crimson king. How does one care for the grass underneath these trees, like fertilize?
Well,
spread fertilizer under there as I'm doing the rest of the lawn, or sometimes they say avoid the drip area?
Well, the areas beneath the trees are very difficult environments for most grasses. They prefer more sun. There are some grasses, the fine leaf fescues, that do much better in the shade. Things like creeping red fescue, hard fescue, chewings fescue, they're quite shade tolerant. So if you have some areas that are kind of sparse, you could try overseeding with those shade-tolerant grasses. As far as the care underneath the trees or around the trees, you want to kind of stay off those areas as much as you can as far as traffic-wise, because those grasses simply can't take that much traffic. So try to stay off as best you can. As far as fertilization, we would actually suggest that you fertilize them less heavily than those areas in the sun. The sunny areas are ideal environments for grasses. The shady areas are less favorable. So in these areas, fertilize less heavily because you don't want to overstimulate these because they just can't handle that. So fertilize a little bit less in the shady areas.
But you can use the same fertilizer, just use less of it.
Right, right. You can use the same fertilizer, but less, and maybe less often. Okay. For example, you might fertilize the sunny areas maybe three times a year. You might want to fertilize the shady areas maybe once or twice a year.
Okay. Well, we don't do excessive fertilization, but the twice a year is about what we do. So
okay.
Then I thought, well, maybe this is wrong. We do have grass growing there. I just want to take care of it properly.
Right. So also keep it mowed high. Don't mow it real short. You want to leave as much of the grass there as you can for photosynthesis. So typically I would say I would never cut it shorter than 2.5 to 3 inches in height in the shady areas.
Thanks a lot for your call, Ken. And for those of us who don't have any grass growing underneath our trees, are there other kinds of ground cover that you recommend for an area like that?
Well, you have options. You can put a ground cover underneath the tree. For example, you could use something like dead nettle, which is a fairly common ground cover, lily of the valley. Now, those two plants tend to be a little bit aggressive, so be aware of that. You could also use something like hostas. You have to plant more because they don't spread that much, but they're a nice ground cover. You could also have things like a stillbees and lungworts. So you can have a nice area. Now, the only problem is with ground covers, you typically can't walk on them like you can grass. So there are some limitations there.
And we just use, for the organic side, we just use mulch. We use
right.
wood mulch and just put it out about, I would say, 3 feet around each tree and not put it directly up against the bark of the tree, the trunk of the tree. Leave a little space there, but just maintain it with, pulling the weeds out of the mulch if they come up. There are some organic herbicides you could use, too, for the mulch around the base of the trees. But we don't, at least where I live, we don't mow under our trees because I have a tendency to smack them with the mower and weed eater.
Well, that's not good.
I try to get it done quickly.
And the mulch will keep it from becoming a muddy mess.
Right. That's a very important thing is you won't have bare ground, so it won't be mud.
All right. Buck is on the line now from Ankeny. Hello, Buck.
Hi. Good morning. This year I had a lot of damage from white grubs in my lawn. I don't like to put that season-long grub preventer on. Is there an organic alternative to that?
Right. That's that product I was talking about, Doom. And if you Google it online, you can get it online. I'm not sure if any local farm or garden supplies carry it, but...
You could definitely look. Now, the thing about grubs is that every lawn has grubs. Every lawn does. And fortunately, though, most years, the numbers are such that they're not going to damage the turf, and we don't have to do a thing. That's the good thing. There are preventatives that you can put on, like in June and July, things like GrubX. And some people do that every year as a matter of course, which is their choice. But a lot of people don't do anything. And most years, the damage is very minor or non-existent. So a lot of people just kind of take that option where they kind of wait and see. And if there really is no problem, they don't do anything at all. Now, we tend to see most grub damage in a dry year, because if you have a turf and it's dry in July and August, that grass is already under tremendous stress because of the dry conditions. Then if you add on to that these grubs feeding on the root system, they just cannot deal with that and the grass will die. So we tend to see most of our grub damage in a dry year, where the grass really can't recover. If we have a wet year and the grass has plenty of moisture, usually they can deal with that. They can develop new roots and they can survive that damage. But in a dry year, they can't. So it tends to be most common in a dry year. And the damage typically occurs in September and early October.
So do you think Buck maybe needs to look for another source for his problems? You think that it might not be white grubs?
Well, if when you have grub damage, it's pretty obvious that you do, because you go out there and you can actually lift up the brown grass because it has no root system. So it kind of comes up like a loose piece of carpeting. Now, if you have grass that's brown and you go out there and pull it and it doesn't pull up, then that would suggest something else entirely different. It might be a disease. We had some very wet, very humid, very warm temperatures most of the summer, and those conditions do create conditions favorable for disease. So if it doesn't pull up, but it's brown, then I would suspect disease.
All right. Buck, thank you so much for your call. And next up we have Penny in Waterloo. Hello, Penny.
Hi. We bought a house about a year ago. I guess it was a year ago May, and at that time it had a huge, beautiful flowering crab in the front. The owners told us it was called a snowdrift crab, and it did not it does not produce fruit, and it did very well last spring. This spring it bloomed pretty well. This was our first spring in it. It bloomed pretty well, but then when the snowdrift, the blooms went away, it just really didn't leaf out very nicely. My husband let it go till midsummer, and he trimmed out a few dead branches, and I heard on one of your shows that the crabs had some problems this spring, and they were dying early. I don't remember what the cause was, so we thought, oh, it's just a bad season. And boy, this summer, it looks bad already. It looks like it's almost a winter tree now, and We haven't done anything else. We had the nursery come out and look at it, and they said it just might have lived out its life. It's about 31 years old. Was built with a house. Do you think there's anything we can do to save it?
Well,
it is a gorgeous tree.
Yeah, there are a number of crab apples as far as varieties. There is a snow drift. Also, and there's also a spring snow.
Oh.
And the spring snow has white flowers, does not produce fruit.
Okay.
A snow drift also has white flowers, but does produce fruit. So if it doesn't produce fruit, I would suspect it might be spring snow.
Spring snow, okay.
Okay, now spring snow is widely planted because it doesn't produce fruit. That's the advantage. The drawback is that spring snow is very susceptible to apple scab, which is a fungal disease. And apple scab loves wet weather in spring and early summer. And what happens is when you have a wet spring, early summer, you see the spotting on the foliage, the leaves turn yellow and they fall off. So by midsummer, if you have a wet spring and early summer, you may have a spring snow that has very few flowers, leaves on it because of that leaf disease.
That sounds about right.
In fact, as we walked over here to the studio, there are a number of spring snow crabapples on campus, and they have very few leaves. They almost look like winter or fall. Mm-hmm. So that may be the problem. Now, with apple scab, that is a fungal disease. It will cause leaf drop, and by midsummer, the plants may not look very attractive, but it typically does not kill them. It doesn't do that. It does weaken them. They're obviously not very attractive in mid to late summer, so it does affect their appearance, but it doesn't kill them. Usually we don't spray for that. We could in the spring of the year with a fungicide, but you'd have to probably spray the tree 3 to 4 times and do that every year. So when most people consider that, they don't do anything. They kind of live with it. Raking the leaves up as they fall, removing them from the area and destroying them might help a little bit as far as reducing the problem next spring. But I wonder if you may have actually spring snow instead of snow drift.
Okay. Well, Penny, thank you so much for your call. And we have time for, I think, one more question here. This is John in Iowa City. Hello, John.
Hi. I was just calling a real quick question. We just planted some rose bushes on the south side of our house in about mid-July, and they're doing great, but I wanted to know if there's anything I need to do to protect them for the winter. I need to put straw over them, or do you have any suggestions?
Are they a hybrid tea type? Do you know?
Ooh, I'm not sure.
Okay. Let's say they're a modern type rose, like a hybrid tea or a floribunda. If they are, they're not very cold hardy, and we would typically suggest going out around Thanksgiving, maybe a little bit before then, and taking some soil and covering the bottom 8 to 12 inches of the rose canes with soil. Soil is a very good insulator, should protect them very nicely. If it's an old-fashioned shrub rose, they're perfectly hardy. They need no protection whatsoever in the winter.
All right, so just a little extra soil on the roots.
On top of the canes, yeah, covering the
on
canes.
Top. All right, perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for your call, John. And since we're talking about getting ready for winter, Andy in Fort Dodge has another question along those lines. Hi, Andy.
Good morning. I have some wisteria plants that I've planted around a pergola in my backyard, one on each corner of the pergola to grow up and provide some nice foliage and color in the spring. I was curious what I need to do with those for the winter, if I should be pruning back any of the lower vines on those and save the energy for the strong ones that have grown, or what do I need to do?
No, I wouldn't do a thing in the fall. You can prune them in the spring if you'd like, if you need to, but I would not do anything in the fall. As long as it's a hardy variety, it should be okay. If you have them growing in areas where you don't want them to grow, I would prune those off early next spring, like in March, early April.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Andy. We have an email from another John in Iowa City who says, is one way to get the garden ready for spring to lay down straw in the fall, and should anything else be put down besides the straw?
Yeah, straw's a good option, too. A lot of people that make their own compost have straw in the compost, Our general rule of thumb is one part nitrogen to four parts carbon. So if you're putting, if you're mixing your manure with straw, you know, go for that ratio. And so you'll have the straw in the homemade compost already. And I mean, that's what we use on the farm. But for your garden, you could use just straight straw, anything to insulate, protect it over the winter. If you have tilled up soil, would be good.
All right. And Stan in Fairfield has one final quick question. He wants to know when the best time to harvest sweet potatoes is.
You typically do that right before that first frost or freeze.
All right. Is that basically the same time as white potatoes?
No, typically with the actual Irish potato, we harvest those usually right about now when the vines die back. They typically die back in late summer. With the sweet potatoes, they keep on growing until that first frost or freeze, so we can usually wait on those.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture, and you're headed off on vacation, so we'll talk to you in a few weeks, Richard.
Okay, thanks. Right,
thank you. And Kathleen Dellett, an associate professor in the Department of Horticulture at Iowa State. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Charity.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Russell Mansky in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. And you can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up on Tuesday, we will be talking with Patricia O'Connor, the word maven, and we'd love to hear from you. I hope you have a wonderful long weekend. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.